You're an ideal recruit. A perfect soldier, not a single mark against you in all these years. So you're probably thinking about going to tell on me right now. Let your superiors know that you've got a captive resistance spy. But if you do that, Cardinal, I won't tell you about Phasma. You leave this room, and I'll be dead before you return. I promise you that.
He snorts, but he does turn away from the door. And why would you do that? Despite the chill in the room, sweat trickles down her forehead, and she shakes her head to flick it away before it can burn her eyes.
You're willing to die for your ideals? Is it so inconceivable I might be willing to die for mine?
He steps closer to her, but not in menace, with a sort of religious fervor.
For the resistance? Yes, that's foolish. They don't care about you. They don't care about anyone. They thrive on chaos.
Vi snorts.
Hate to break it to you, big guy, but most people just want to live their small lives, not get caught up and die in someone else's battle for ultimate power. The resistance is about freedom, about doing what's right, and stopping the bullies and tyrants.
She can't help smiling as she thinks about Baako, studying to be a diplomat and excited by the prospect of doing good on Pantora.
And the Resistance rewards good people willing to help with that. If you don't like the way you're being treated here, if you've been, say, overlooked for a promotion, or if you get tired of sending children planetside to oppress innocent populations with blasters and flamethrowers, the Resistance would give you a full pardon.
Defect to the Resistance!
He barks a laugh and leans back against the wall, arms crossed.
And why would I want to do something that stupid?
Because people who try to take Phasma down usually meet ugly ends. At least they did on Parnassus. I assume they do on this ship, too.
Speaking of which, our records indicate Parnassus was destroyed.
How was it destroyed if your men pulled it off my ship's log?
He rolls his eyes.
The planet is still there, but the water level rose.
Phasma's people
are gone.
Vi smiles slyly.
They're not all gone. Someone just wants you to think that. I'm surprised you believed it. And that she hasn't wiped it from your maps completely.
And why would Phasma do that?
Because she doesn't want anyone to know what happened the day Brendel Hux fell from the sky. And the day he made a deal with her.
Now Cardinal scoffs, sure he's caught her out.
That's a lie. Brendel Hux did nothing without my knowing it. I was his personal guard.
Then you failed because he was there on Parnassus. I've seen evidence with my own eyes.
Cardinal leans forward, betraying his new interest.
When? How? What happened?
With a sigh, Vi leans her head back. Her feet are killing her, and there's a dull throb behind her eyes. Every part of her hurts. She can't escape the smell of her own burnt flesh. But she must continue. She has to give him what he wants, but she needs to take her time doing so and hopefully, maybe, win him over to her cause. Or at least keep him from killing her.
I'll get to Brendel when it's time. First, you need to know Phasma's story.
Cardinal shakes his head.
I don't have a lot of time. Get to the part about General Hux. If she caused him harm or actively worked against him, I just need evidence. Something to pin her with.
The droid beeps in warning, and his mouth twists as he looks at it.
No. Iris is right. Tell me everything.
I have no way of knowing what might ultimately be important. Which is excellent, as that's what Vi was going to do anyway. She wouldn't be good at her job if she gave up the best information that easily.
I agree with your droid. You need to hear the whole story. To truly understand who you're trying to take down.
His thumb plays over the remote.
And why do I need to understand her when I just want to destroy her?
Because every great hunter knows it's paramount to understand your prey. Especially when they're a predator hunting you in return. For all the stories Siv told me, she made certain that I understood one thing very well.
And what's that?
Vi looks into Cardinal's eyes, hard, to make him understand.
Phasma will do anything to survive.
Six. On Parnassos, 10 years ago. At the time this story happened, according to Siv, there was a child among the Skyr, which was a big deal. The people of Parnassos valued children above all else, for they knew that without children, their band would die out completely within a few generations. In the last 10 years, however, babies had become rare and pregnancy most often ended in tragedy. Whether it was something in the air, or the acidic rain, or maybe a lack of vital nutrients, most children were lost before their mothers' bellies even began to swell. But a healthy baby had been born to a Skyr woman named Ylva, and the clan was committed to keeping mother and child safe. By the time she was 5, Ylva's child was old enough to hunt frogs and urchins and contribute to the clan, so she was given the name Frey. It was a rare thing that a child lived long enough to be given a name, and Frey brought hope to the Skyr clan and was loved and indulged by everyone. Thanks to her small size and nimble fingers, she was able to venture into caves the rest of the clan couldn't explore, and to snatch birds' eggs from the narrow shelves of rock on which they nested. She was the first child to reach the age of 5 in years, the only one thus far of her generation, and everyone loved her and doted on her. Keldo and Phasma had been firmly in charge for about 2 years, and the group was flourishing. Although she still kept her warriors close, Phasma considered it her responsibility to keep everyone in the Skyr group in good physical condition and well-trained with weapons, including those who had no talent for it, or those too old or infirm to actively defend the group. Even little Frey begged Phasma to teach her to fight, and Phasma made her a child-sized axe out of stone and driftwood. Together, they would playfully practice on the floor of the Nautilus cave whenever it was dry. One day, Siv and Phasma were sparring on the cliffs, leaping from rock spire to rock spire as they parried and sliced with their blades near the edge of their territory. It took agility and strength, maneuvering over sharp rocks with the crashing ocean far below. Suddenly, Phasma put up a hand to stop the fight and used her ancient pair of quadnocks to scan the horizon.
"Balder," she said. "Are the claws attacking?" Siv asked, glad she had her scythes in hand.
The Claws were a local war band led by a particularly vicious Dug named Balder. All of the Skyr folk were human, but they had stories passed down from their ancestors suggesting that there had once been Dugs, plus Chadrafan and Rodians among their numbers. Balder, as far as they knew, was the last of his kind. The Claws had more people and more fighters in particular, but what Balder didn't have was the brain power of the siblings who led the Skyr.
"It's not an attack. It's just Balder. But he's watching us. Has been for a while now."
Siv's hands tightened on the hilts of her blades.
"Do you think he wants the land? The Nautilus?"
Phasma turned her knocks in the other direction, toward the bulk of the stone cliffs where their band lived their communal life. The people were relaxed and working. Keldo sat on a soft skin, apportioning out water, and Torben was teaching Frey how to swing her axe.
"I think he wants Frey."
"Why?"
"Because she's the most precious thing we have."
Siv considered it and asked,
"Then why now?"
"Because now she's useful. The Claws didn't have to spend the time and resources to keep her alive when she was an infant. But now they'd be happy to use her."
The thought made Siv's blood boil.
"We can't let that happen."
Phasma looked again in the direction of the Claw territory.
"No, we can't."
From then on, Phasma posted 2 guards at the edge of their territory, and every shift reported Balder's spies keeping watch. So Phasma watched the Claws watching her people, and she hatched a plan. This was notable because until now she'd always worked in tandem with her brother, Keldo, as if they were 2 arms on the same body. but this time she told only her warriors. She didn't mention to Keldo that they would be raided soon. And she didn't tell him that she'd scouted into the Claw territory to spy on Balder in turn. But Siv knew. Finally, on a moonless night, it happened. Phasma and her people were sleeping in their net hammocks, strung between the tallest rock spires, when the ululating cries of the claws sounded, echoing off the stone. But Phasma was ready. She swung from her hammock, fully awake and brandishing her spear, leaping from rock to rock toward the most secure hammock, where Ylva always slept with Frey strapped to her chest. Her warriors likewise burst out of their hammocks, armed and awake, ready to fight. The rest of the Skyre folk had no idea the raid was coming, but they rallied and readied their weapons. The first of the Skyre's night lookouts screamed and fell, cut down by Balder himself, her body splashing into the ocean below and quickly being dragged down into the dark water by gleaming white teeth at least a meter long. Phasma watched it happen, too far away to save the guard, and screamed her rage. The Skyre had not lost a member in many moons, and a dirty way it was to die.
"The Mother is there,"
Balder shouted, hanging from an outcropping and pointing to where Ylva cowered in a rock cleft, arms wrapped around the bundle strapped to her chest.
"But I am here," Phasma taunted.
The people of the Skyre moved to circle and protect Ylva, and Phasma moved between Balder and her people.
"You don't scare me, girl child," Balder growled.
Although he was much smaller than Phasma, the Dug had the natural agility and aggression of his species on his side, as well as a unique fighting style, thanks to the fact that he walked on his hands and used his nimble lower legs to manipulate his weapons. Phasma had never personally fought him before, but she wasn't going to give him any advantage. As he circled, Phasma leapt for him. In one hand she held her spear, topped with its slender blade, and in the other hand she had an axe of rusty metal. Of the many remnants of the old mines that her people scavenged, nothing was as useful as the old saw blades and machinery strong enough to hew through rock itself. She drew first blood on Balder and laughed, taking a fierce joy in the fight. Before now, the raids had been mostly tests, but this battle was for real. It was hard to keep track of who died and who lived as the members of the Skyre fought for their lives. Although they kept a tight circle around Ylva, some Claw members managed to leap or fight through the protective ring. Torben stood closest to Ylva, the last line of defense with his mighty clubs bristling with spikes. For all that she had her bundle strapped to her chest, Ylva fought as ferociously as anyone, taking down two Claw fighters with the rusty saw blades Phasma had taught her to wield. Even Keldo took down a Claw for all that he could fight only in one place, tethered to his stone spire by lines and forced to fight on one foot. But Phasma was the warrior who did the most damage. Clad in her mask and climbing spikes, she was strong, tall, quick, and the master of every weapon she carried. For all that Balder had the physical advantage, Phasma fought like she craved death at the enemy's hand, like she longed to fall on Balder's Beheada, a famed Dug weapon he painstakingly crafted from an old mining blade. But the Beheada was a weapon for distance, and Phasma quickly closed with Balder, fighting past his own circle of defense and forcing him to turn away from Ylva and use more intimate tools to best her. It was like a dance, Siv told me. A teen girl dressed like a monster, weapons spinning in her hands as she fought an adult male Dug. Phasma parried every hit and struck back until Balder dripped blood from his stone-gray skin. One of the reasons he ruled was because he didn't fall ill from his wounds as easily as the humans so often did. But he was soon panting and slowing down. His knife fell from his cut foot as if the appendage were numb, but still he continued fighting. When Phasma lopped off one of his ear fins, dripping with ceremonial baubles, Balder finally bellowed in rage, spun and swung away, calling a retreat. The claws followed him gladly, for they had lost a dozen members and sustained their own damage without obtaining the child they sought. Phasma stood tall on her stone spire by a Skyre flag, hefted her axe in the air and screamed her war cry. Her people gathered around, including Ilva, who was exhausted having been the focus of the attack.
"How is the child?" Keldo called.
But when Ilva unbuckled her burden, there was no sign of Frey. Her bundle was full of ragged blankets. The Skyr people gasped, shocked that despite being routed, Baldur's people had managed to steal the child they'd all been willing to die to protect. And that's when Phasma untied her bulky coat to show that she'd carried Frey herself, the child strapped to her chest and unharmed.
"You took a great risk, sister," Keldo said, looking very grim.
"And it paid off. We won't be seeing Baldur for a while, if ever." That got everyone's attention. As Phasma unbuckled Frey and transferred the child back to her mother, Keldo pressed her.
"And why is that? After tonight, I would think him twice as likely to attack now that we've denied him his prize."
"Did you see how Baldur couldn't fight any longer? How his weapons fell from his feet and he looked at his toes in horror? I tried another gambit and it was successful."
"And you didn't tell me?"
"I wasn't sure if it would work. We've always assumed that wounds fester because of the air, but I realized that it's from the lichen on the rocks. Even touching it makes your fingertips go numb. So I pounded the lichen to make a paste and smeared it on my blades. That is why Baldur weakened. Even dug blood is no match for poison." She held up her axe, and it was clear to see that a light green substance was on the metal, mixed in with blood and bits of gray flesh.
"Why did you not share this with the tribe?"
Keldo asked, his rage barely contained. "When we all could have benefited from this knowledge. I had to test it first. I had to be sure. And I'm telling you now."
"Sister, I am ashamed of you."
Phasma hooked her weapons on her belt and made her way to the spire on which he sat, his good leg and his half leg dangling down over the churning ocean far below. "Are you ashamed that I bested our enemy, saved a mother and child, and protected the Skyr's territory? Or are you ashamed that I chose not to include you in my plans?" Keldo carefully considered her, as good leaders do. He knew that to lose his temper would be to lose face.
"We rule together, Phasma. We always have."
Phasma didn't flinch, didn't blink.
"And we still do. But fighting is my province, brother. And today, we fought. And we won!"
She gave a war cry, and the people of the Skyr echoed it, hefting their weapons at the night sky so full of faraway stars.
"While Baldur is crippled and his people recover, we should return the favor. Raid their settlement. Take their territory. They have a plateau big enough for their entire band to sleep on. They light a fire at night, and cook their food, and warm their flesh. Every night! The people of the Skyr deserve to feel that fire's warmth, and to watch our Frey walk on soft ground!"
At that, however, the people did not shout their agreement. They quieted and looked to Keldo. Keldo's face was grim.
"That, sister, I cannot allow. It is one thing to kill to defend our home and our sacred cave, but it is another thing to trespass against a neighbor, no matter how tyrannical. We are good and strong, but we are not murderers. I'd rather sleep free with a clean conscience than warm myself over an innocent person's bones. We should use this period of fragility to forge a peace with Baldur's people. Surely they, like us, understand that if we spent more time surviving and producing children and less time fighting, all our people would be strengthened. If we continue to squabble over nothing, we'll all be gone. One, maybe two more generations, and there will be no one left to fight. Nothing left to fight over."
The people of the Skyr nodded along to these wise words, but Phasma breathed out a hum of disapproval, the steam curling from her mask, which she hadn't yet removed.
"You are too fond of peace," she said simply.
"I am a leader, and a leader does what is best for the people."
Phasma shook her head and turned away.
"I am a fighter. I do what I must to survive. And making peace with Baldur will not save us."
After Phasma had left to sit alone on a far promontory where the Night Guard had fallen, the Skyre voted. It was decided to let Keldo pursue peace with Baldur, although Phasma's warriors voted against it. Keldo's closest confidants helped him make the journey to Claw territory the next day. He did not request his sister's presence or aid. Phasma and her warriors watched, silent, as the procession passed them by. A vote was a vote, after all. As the Dug was unconscious and still healing from the wounds Phasma had inflicted, Baldur's people had no choice but to agree to Keldo's terms. A fragile peace was negotiated between Skyre and Claw, without Phasma and without Baldur. There would be no more raids. They would work together for a shared future, trading goods and encouraging new friendships that might lead to healthy children. Everyone cheered, and Keldo's chosen Skyre folk stood on actual ground for the first time in many years, enjoying the brief safety of Claw Land. Phasma and her warriors had remained behind, standing vigil on their rock spires, guarding the Nautilus and the most helpless members of the clan, as they always had. But they heard the cheers as Keldo's procession returned. Phasma wore her mask, but her hands were in fists. She turned her back on the celebration and stared out at the ocean. For their very different roles in this new peace, Phasma and Keldo were celebrated as heroes. But for Phasma, it wasn't a peace. It was a betrayal. Maybe she'd withheld her plans from Keldo, but he'd directly opposed her, then scorned her. She would not forget it.
7. On the Absolution.
Vi looks up. Cardinal is mesmerized by the story, leaning avidly forward.
"So you're saying she was a hero on her home planet?"
he asks with a sad chuckle.
"That she saved mothers and children and invented new weapons against her enemies? That she deserves her reputation as the perfect soldier?"
He scoffs.
"Unfortunately, that information doesn't exactly help me. There's a meeting tomorrow. General Hux will be there, and I need something that can take down Captain Phasma for good."
"Little Armitage is coming over to play? What's the occasion?"
"That's not mine to know. I'm a soldier, remember? Now tell me something I can use."
Vi clears her dry throat and shakes her head, feeling like a schoolteacher with a particularly stubborn student.
"That's just one story. Just a taste of her life on Parnassos. Her origin story, say. It's easy to be a hero when your own survival is aligned with someone else's. When your victory is a victory for your entire clan. On Parnassos, you contribute to the group or you don't last long. There was nothing to lose in her fight with Baldur. Her group needed that kid to keep their clan going. Saving Frey was saving herself, even if it looked a little sappy on the surface. The real information you need to take away from this idyllic scene is that Phasma betrayed her brother and held a grudge. Sure, she saved the kid. And sure, she invented a new weapon. But she didn't let anyone else take a bit of her fanfare, and she didn't want peace. If it had been up to her, she would have killed every Claw."
Cardinal says nothing, just rubs his hands through his hair and stares into nowhere. Vi can almost see him doing the math in his head. See that the Phasma he knows now is the same Phasma who once stood on Parnassos, weapons in hand. But this story alone won't be enough to convince him of what Phasma really is. He'll need more. And he wants it by tomorrow so he can, what, tattle on Phasma? Get her kicked out of the First Order? Their rivalry must be more serious than the Resistance had led her to believe. They told her Cardinal and Phasma were equals, each with their own domain. But that's definitely not how Cardinal feels. This is no little workplace tiff or friendly contest. And if Vi learned anything on Parnassos, it's that Phasma has her own plans for Cardinal. That she wouldn't let a brown-nosing rival stick around for long, especially if he became a threat. Vi can see how the story is beginning to crack him. How the more he thinks about Phasma, the less formal First Order soldier he is, and the more angry little boy he might become. She's got to encourage that, keep Cardinal's emotions hot, and push him to break his careful programming. That's the key to getting him on her side. But she's also got to avoid making him so angry that he kills her. The remote is never far from Vi's mind. She can't take many more of those uncontrolled jolts of electricity. It's imperative that Cardinal doesn't lose his temper again. A fine balance to walk, and she's definitely not at her best just now. She swallows audibly, chapped lips parting. Hey, how about a little water, maybe? I get parched laying the groundwork for the really juicy stories. Cardinal wags a finger. We don't have much time, just tell me. That's not how it works. If I die of dehydration or electrocution, Phasma's story dies with me. Do I look like I brought you a picnic lunch? This is an interrogation, not a party. It's going to be less of a party when I pass out.
The floating droid, Iris, he called it, zips around Vi and beeps imperatively at Cardinal. Vi wants to tease him for taking orders from a droid, but she knows well enough that when Gigi has new information to add, she always listens.
She's going to miss that cheerful little astromech.
She makes sure she's panting when Iris hovers right in front of her face. Cardinal mutters, I know, at his droid, and stands right in front of Vi, close enough for her to spit in his eye, if she had enough moisture, which she doesn't. He's from Jakku. He knows what dehydration looks like, and he'll have no choice but to agree with his droid that she's not looking so good. Something about the shocks this machine doles out did a number on her body. The droid's readouts must confirm that she's not playing him. Cardinal sighs and stands, putting on his helmet.
I don't need to say it, but don't move. Don't try to escape. I'm taking the remote. I'm leaving Iris behind, and I'm locking the door. Can I trust you?
She's not going to tell him that if he let her out of the chair right now, she'd just fall to the ground and twitch. Her muscles are burned out, her bones aching. She also won't tell him that building trust is exactly what she's trying to do, and this is a great way to accomplish it.
You can trust me because we made a deal, but when you come back and find me completely unmoved, I want you to remember it.
Why?
She gives him a small smile that cracks her lips.
Because I think we're going to make some more deals down the road. A little food wouldn't go amiss. This machine is like one big metallic hangover. It's terrible.
His voice through the helmet is impersonal and cold.
Of course it's terrible. It's supposed to be. It's a torture device.
With that, he taps on the control panel and the door slides open. Vi closes her eyes to enjoy the small breeze and somewhat fresher air before the door shuts. Even though she's pretty sure she could get out if she gave it her all, she doesn't like her odds just yet. Plus, Iris is watching her, a red eye blinking like a warning. Vi is willing to bet this little communications droid has been rigged with some kind of defense mechanism, a laser or a shock arm. She's not going to find out. She checks in on her body from toes to eyes, flexing every joint she can, tightening and then releasing the muscles. She's sore and drained, and her goal will be to somehow get stronger before he releases her from the machine, or she finds a way to break free, either one. As is, she couldn't fight even one of his kid stormtroopers, and she knows it.
Without meaning to, Vi falls asleep. It's dark and warm inside her head, a pleasant cave where she can rest. She startles awake when the door slides open, filled with shiny red. Blinking to refocus her eyes, she does her best to perk back up so Cardinal won't know how very weak she is just now.
"Is that Nerf steak I smell?"
she mumbles.
"It's water and protein. Standard trooper diet."
"I was kidding. It smells like death."
Cardinal takes off his helmet and puts it back on the table. He's smiling, and Vi notes that he has a nice smile. Not that it matters. He's still the enemy. "The protein is still sealed in its packet and therefore has no smell. The only thing in this room with an obvious odor is you. Guess you were in that cockpit for a while, eh?" Vi can't even tip her head to sniff her underarms, but he's probably right. What with the mission, and the shocking, and the being trapped in this murder box of a room, she's likely not a treat for any of the senses.
"I was in there a while, yes,"
she agrees, and they can both hear the rasp in her throat.
"And on Parnassus, which isn't known for the personal fragrance market."
The look Cardinal gives her. Well, she already knew his job involved training the younger recruits, but she can see now why he's good at it. There's a kindness in his eyes, a genuine concern that she wouldn't expect to see in an enemy. He frowns and brings a water bottle to her, extending a straw to help her drink like her mother had when she was a little girl and feverish on Choctil. The water tastes fake and like it's been blitzed with vitamins and medicine, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. She swallows deeply and sputters, and he pulls the straw away.
"Not too much. You'll make yourself sick."
She smiles up at him, water still on her lips.
"You just don't want to have to clean it up if I vomit."
"It's the only possible way you could smell worse."
That gets a real laugh, and she's glad to play along. Good cop is always better than bad cop, and her endgame has a better chance of fruition if they can build some camaraderie. It's a surprise, actually, to find that anyone working for the First Order can be pleasant. Vi expected an angry, indoctrinated, brainwashed bully. A jerk. But he came from Jakku, didn't he? Lived there into his teens, probably, and had a personality before the propaganda machine pulled him in. And his personality is, thus far, very different from what she knows of Phasma. He gives her a few spoonfuls of dreary gray paste, and she's so thankful to have something in her stomach that she doesn't complain about the taste.
Well, maybe she'll complain a little.
"You know, you get to eat real food in the Resistance," she says, "made of actual animals and plants. With these crazy things called spices and salt, it'll blow your mind."
He sits down and waves that away tiredly.
"I grew up on Jakku. A few sand rats, a stringy bird every now and then. Sometimes I found a nest of crickets if I was lucky. I'm not concerned about my palate. But tell me, why'd you join the Resistance?"
Vi shakes her head and takes a moment to think about the right answer.
"I didn't join it. That would suggest I work for free, or that I went looking for them, or for a cause to throw myself at. I'm for hire, and they offered to pay me to do what I do best, and I had the time, so I accepted."
His look suggests he knows she's mostly lying.
"Oh, so if the First Order offered you more credits, you'd flip sides right now?"
She can only shrug.
"No, never.
You caught me. I won't work for the bad guys. I have the luxury of only working for organizations with both credits and morals."
Cardinal's smile disappears. "Morals? The Resistance? Are you joking? They advocate anarchy and destruction, selfishness, not morals."
"And the First Order is about morals? And not just the need to hold dominion over the galaxy?"
He shakes his head sadly, like she's a student who's disappointed him and needs a good lecture.
"It's right there in the name. First Order.
First
Order. Fixing the mess left by the Republic and now the New Republic. Getting rid of bloated diplomats and lobbyists who don't represent real people with real problems. Bringing equality to all. The old system of government is ludicrous and doomed to fail. Sentient beings are incapable of making the choices that are in their best interests in the long run. The whole point of the First Order is stability.
Easy to get the unstable to join up then, isn't it?
Vi shoots back.
What about the individual? What about freedom? With so many people on so many worlds, don't our differences and our unique choices make us beautiful?
Cardinal scoffs, leaning his back against the table, one hand on his blaster as if he can't stand the notion.
Our differences make us vulnerable. Vulnerable to misrule, to corruption, to getting mired in bureaucracy instead of effecting real change. Stability ensures progress for everyone. That's the whole point of government.
Why, Cardinal? You sound like someone who doesn't even know he's just a tool for a tyrant.
And you sound like someone who just wants to watch the galaxy burn.
Vi grins, her gold eyes sparkling.
Yes, well, some of us do see better by firelight.
Cardinal huffs in annoyance and feeds her some more protein. Vi swallows it down, hating everything about it.
But he doesn't even know how horrible the grub is, does he? He doesn't know what he's missing.
That's the problem with indoctrination. The whole point of the First Order's kind of education is to stop someone from thinking and instead kick their emotions into gear. Make them hate everything else so they'll cling to what you give them. It's hard to think for yourself when fear and anger are driving the shuttle. But he can't see that because he's inside of it. And he clearly thinks he's in the right.
Look, I didn't know what it felt like to have a full stomach until Brendel Hux found me. I'd never slept off the sand, never gone a night without waking to rats or sand fleas or something worse nibbling at me. The other kids were cruel. The adults were worse. That's what your New Republic does. Ignores poor backwater planets and funnels money to the rich planets that can afford to have a voice in the Senate. Who spoke for Jakku? No one. Who spoke for the boy I was? No one.
And what did the First Order do for Jakku, eh? Is it better now that you've left it behind? Are the children well-fed and getting proper medical care?
Cardinal tosses down the paste and stands, his hands in fists.
They will be. It's not yet time. But that time is coming.
Haven't you realized yet?
Vi asks.
It's never going to be fair. Even if you win, children will be forgotten. You were lucky. Your life got better. But that doesn't mean Brendel Hux was good.
And what about Brendel Hux?
Cardinal is in her face now, and she wants to turn away but can't. He smells of sweat and metal and that low and simmering rage that Vi has smelled on men all across the galaxy. As if his anger seeps out of his pores because he's unable to focus it on its true target. This anger can destroy a man. Or it can be harnessed. Used. A tool for the greater good. She just has to figure out how to get him in the harness and point him in the right direction. He's still in her face. It makes it hard to focus. She clears her throat.
Patience, Vi says. Patience and a little more water. I was just getting to the part about Phasma and Brendel.
Cardinal pushes away from the interrogation chair, rattling her bones within the metal cage. She knows he would love to hit her, but he can't. The electricity isn't personal enough. His anger at Phasma is a mad thing that hasn't yet found its target. Whether he refuses to hit her because he pities her or because he's been programmed, she doesn't know. Perhaps he could hit her if his superiors gave an order, but his superiors don't know he's down here. They don't know she's down here either. And she needs to keep it that way. She says nothing, doesn't begin her story, just licks her lips. She needs that water. The droid beeps urgently as if reading her mind. Cardinal fiddles with the screen on the wall, probably checking in to make sure he's not being missed. Vi is silent. He wouldn't turn on a comm, not with her down here, but she's still not going to take the risk of threatening their fragile peace. Finally, satisfied with whatever he finds, he brings her the water and waits for her to close her lips around the tube and drink.
Not too much,
he warns again, as only someone who's nearly died in a desert can.
Wait,
she says, suddenly realizing that the entire flavor of their discussion has changed. He's broken character with her, given away personal information.
Why are you being so nice to me?
Cardinal sits back on his chair and smiles.
Because while I was in my quarters, I did a little more digging. You didn't tell me you had a brother.
Vi is immediately awake and alert, straining against her bonds.
I have no one. You know nothing.
Something tells me that Bo'oko doesn't know about your secret life. After all, spies aren't very good for the careers of diplomats, are they? Even diplomats shipped off to marshy moons.
She's panting now, furious and terrified. She never even told the resistance about Bo'oko. She changed her name to keep him safe, paid very high-priced slicers to bury her path. And yet Cardinal knows.
Tell me what you want,
she says, voice low and deadly. Cardinal tosses the remote in the air and catches it.
Same thing I've wanted all along. Tell me about Phasma and Brendel Hux.
Vi swallows, clears her throat, and starts talking.
Eight. On Parnassus, 10 years ago. Once an ongoing peace had been established with Baldur's tribe, things should have been good for Phasma and the Skyre. Or at least as good as they could be on a primitive world where every day was a fight just to eat while also not falling between rocks and getting eaten by giant sharks. But then came the day when Brendel Hux fell from the sky. Siv said he never told them what he was doing in the area. Conducting scans, looking for children to steal, who knows? The only thing that can be said for sure is that the old orbital defense system of Parnassos targeted him, hit his ship, and sent him plummeting toward the unforgiving topography of the now primitive planet. Phasma and her warriors began making preparations the moment they saw the explosion high overhead. As the ship's remains streaked across the sky, Phasma tracked it with her quadnox, taking careful note of the direction in which it fell. At the very least, ships like this could be pillaged. At most, there was always a hope that they could be salvaged and used to get off-planet. No one alive had seen such ships do anything but fall and crash, but they were evidence of the larger galaxy beyond Parnassus, of a future that had been denied them. It was painful living on such a treacherous planet with so many reminders of the ease and technology that had once been taken for granted. At the very least, there would be metal, tech, clothes, medicines, food, and possibly working blasters scattered around what was left of the ship. These were the greatest riches in Phasma's world. But they had to hurry. Other groups in other territories would also be watching and preparing for the journey. Falling stars, as they called them, were rare, and this ship was the shiniest thing the Skyre had ever seen, so bright that they had to shield their eyes as it arrowed down toward the planet. Part of the ship popped off and floated down separately, headed for the area where the Skyre territory bordered Baldur's territory, which made it all the more important to hurry. As Phasma and her warriors hefted their packs to depart, Keldo called out to stop his sister.
It looks like it will be long to the claws, he said, sitting on the stone spire Torben had hewn into a chair for him. Our peace is more important than any goods on that ship. I forbid you from attacking Baldur's people and breaking our hard-won truce.
Phasma did not cease her preparations.
But this ship is bigger than most, and appears to be undamaged. It could still be functioning. It could carry the riches and technology we need to save our entire clan. I will not pass up the chance at a better life for us just because you don't want to get into a shouting match with that tyrant.
Sister, don't you see? If we all worked together instead of fighting, we'd have a better chance at survival. Our bands are in the process of joining. We will soon share the bounty of the ship.
Brother, I think you're the one who's blind.
Baldur would never share a ship with us. He may agree to your peace now, when he's weak and wounded. But if he regains his strength, nothing will stop him from destroying us. He will demand revenge, for all that we were only defending our own. You dream of peace, but he dreams of power. We must strike now, while he can't fight back. Part of the ship is near Baldur's territory, but the bigger part has fallen in the wastelands, and if we hurry, it will be ours for the taking. No one owns the wastelands.
But you must go through Baldur's territory to get there, and we don't know what dangers wait beyond our borders.
But we do know what dangers await us here. It's time to take a risk. We need that ship.
Keldo finally conceded to his sister.
I can't deny that the falling star might be our best hope of survival. Take your warriors and see where the ship has landed. If it's in Skyr territory, take what you can. If it's in Baldur's territory, leave it be. And if it's in the wastelands, I will trust you to parley with our ally and find a compromise. The peace must be kept at all costs.
Phasma nodded at this, her face grim.
I will do my best to keep the peace.
Siv noted at the time that Phasma's eyes simmered with rage, and that her voice was hard and unforgiving. But what could Keldo do? The most powerful warrior stood at Phasma's side, and thanks to his leg, Keldo himself couldn't even chase after her to rebuke her. He had no choice but to take her at her word. Although the Skyr had voted with Keldo for peace, they were of one mind when it came to the possibility of a better future. That ship was their greatest hope. Phasma took her closest four warriors and handpicked eight more, leaving the rest of the Skyr to defend Keldo, Ilva, Frey, and their beloved Nautilus. The journey was not easy, for no journeys on Parnassos are. Well, unless you happen to be in a small, agile starhopper and are fast and clever enough to avoid those orbital cannons and pretty much everything else on the planet that wants to eat you. The Skyr territory was mostly spires of black rock, jagged cliffs, ledges, caves, and occasional tide pools when the ocean was at its lowest. Within their accustomed living area, they maintained a series of zip lines, rope bridges, tethers, nets, and hammocks, and even the least nimble Skyr member could get from place to place without too much trouble. But beyond their nesting place, along their border with the claws, the terrain grew even more dangerous. The bridges weren't sturdy, and one never knew when a support spike might be rusted through or a stone spire crumbling away to nothing. Phasma's warriors were lucky that the ship had crashed during a time of low tides, so they were able to traverse the terrain far more easily than if the tides had been high, not to mention that during high tide the ship might have been swallowed by the sea, or a monster in it. Although she'd lived her entire life near Claw territory, Phasma had little knowledge of what lay beyond the boundaries of Baldur's home. What she'd seen during raids or when scouting suggested his land was far superior to the Skyr land, with flat, rocky plateaus, actual soil, and sparse green grasses. Many times she'd argued with Keldo over the benefits of seizing Claw territory, raiding farther in and planting Skyr flags to claim some of the plateau land and finally give her people what felt like much-needed breathing room. But Keldo refused to even consider a land grab, and the majority of the Skyr voted along with him. Not all the Skyr folk were as skilled and tenacious as Phasma's warriors, and although their 20 middling fighters could defend the group as a whole, the older, weaker, and wounded members of the clan were happy enough to cling to the Nautilus and the rough but predictable life it provided. They were scared to take what they needed, which infuriated Phasma to no end. Still, Phasma's knowledge of the world consisted of the sea on one side and Baldur's plateaus on the other. What might lay in the wastelands beyond Claw territory was entirely conjecture. Keldo reasoned it could only be yet more rock and sea, but Phasma longed to know if there might be different places, different things worth fighting for on the other side. If the Claw were true allies,
Phasma once reasoned while speaking privately with her warriors, then Baldur's people should let them traverse the land, if not share it, rather than keeping the territorial lines so carefully drawn and tended. They set off immediately, 13 Skyr carrying the supplies that could mean the difference between life and death in a harsh land. Skins of water and dried foods that could travel well, strips of meat jerky and salty sea vegetables shriveled in the sun. Net hammocks and blankets and weapons galore. Climbing spikes and rappelling gear. They traveled with long lines of woven rope strung between each person, the only safety net should someone slip and plummet toward the raging waves below. Considering the danger of cuts and abrasions, they wore thick gloves and boots of leather, tipped with claws to help dig into stone. And they wore their masks, always, both to protect their faces from the elements, and to strike fear in the hearts of whoever or whatever saw them approach. Siv had apportioned out her oracle salve beforehand, ensuring that the warriors would have their strength. Under their masks, each person wore thick stripes of the dark green salve over their cheeks. The journey took time. Gosta was first in line, thanks to her agility and lightness. She tested the footholds, planted the spikes that held the lines, and moved ahead to make sure the path could support the rest of the group. Phasma followed her and helped her plot the route. Siv and Carr and the rest traveled after. Mighty Torben came last, both the heaviest and the best defense against anything that might surprise the group from behind. It was their first scouting mission outside their territory in years, and Phasma made sure her people were secure as they ventured forth. When they reached the line of flags delineating the borderlands between the Skyr's territory and Baldur's, Phasma called a halt and pulled out her quadnox. The borderlands here seemed endless and were characterized by their harshness and their uselessness as a home base. Tall fingers of broken rock stuck up like spikes, and far below them was not the ocean the Skyr were so accustomed to, but yet more jagged stone littered with bones, trash, and brightly colored fungi. Scanning the area, Phasma caught sight of one of the claw sentries standing guard on a wider stone spire. Putting away her quadnox, she looked at each of her warriors in turn. "Gosta, take him down," she said, pointing at the figure on the horizon. Gosta nodded, unclipped her harness from the group's rope lines, and took off, leaping athletically from spire to spire. One of the Skyr who wasn't in Phasma's inner circle looked aghast.
"But Keldo said we must maintain the alliance at all costs."
Phasma stepped over to share the spire he stood upon, glaring intently into his eyes through her ferocious mask. "Keldo isn't here, and he doesn't know how things work outside of our territory. Baldur won't allow us to cross the border, especially if he also wants the fallen ship. That guard stands between us and the thing that could save us." The man looked as if he wanted to say more, but his boots sent pebbles tumbling down, the stone tower barely big enough to hold them both. Phasma seemed somehow to lean forward without having moved, and the man edged back, lost his footing, and began to fall. At the last moment, Phasma snatched his arm out of the air and caught him, their bodies balanced to keep them both from toppling over the edge.
"Are you with me or against me?" she whispered.
"I'm with the Skyr," he said quickly.
"When Keldo isn't here, I am the Skyr."
Her grip loosened, just enough to make him wobble.
"With you, Phasma. I'm with you."
She released him, righted him, and leapt to the next rock spire as if she hadn't nearly killed one of her own people.
"Then everyone find a steady perch and ready your weapons. If Gosta does her job well enough, we shouldn't need them.
Yet."
The 12 Skyr folk squatted in place and drew their clubs, knives, axes, and spears. It was a new situation, a group of them out in an unfamiliar place and aggressing for the first time. They were no longer on safe ground. Phasma held up her quadnox, and when she laughed a short, brutal laugh, everyone tensed.
"The sentry is down. Gosta is signaling that the way is clear. Let's hurry."
No one spoke against her again as they moved silently and swiftly into the borderlands. When they reached Gosta, the girl pointed down to a man's body wedged far below at an odd angle, blood painting the rocks. Phasma nodded and picked up her quadnox, scanning the path ahead for the next sentry, but they were either too far off or hidden.
You, she pointed to one of the Skyr folk, stay here in the sentry's place.
Why?
The woman asked, and it took some bravery.
So that when the next sentry looks or returns, they'll find someone where they expect someone to be. If you meet anyone who isn't Skyr, kill them.
The woman looked like she wanted to argue, but the body down below convinced her otherwise. She merely nodded and knelt to tie her rope to the dead sentry's climbing spike. They left her and continued, following Gosta's slow progress across the rock formations as she found the best route. Now, the thing about that part of Parnassos is that it was very hard to hide in. When the only way to move was to stand on top of a very tall rock, all without trees or bushes, it was impossible to remain concealed for very long. The upside of this problem was that the enemy was likewise limited. And so it came to be that Phasma and the Skyr folk realized they were approaching an unusual circumstance. Far away on Baldur's Plateau, all the Claw people were gathered. And luckily, they were all looking away from the borderlands and the approach of their supposed allies. Baldur himself was shouting, and the main thing he kept repeating was,
Hurry up! Bring them! Bring them to me now!
The Claw land Phasma had so coveted was bigger than she remembered it, or perhaps the Skyr had shrunken so small that Baldur's territory simply seemed large by comparison. The plateau stood tall with red dirt and greenery here and there. It was big enough for all of the Claw people to stand on, and a few even lounged or sat, especially the very old who gathered near a fire. No children were in sight, which explained the desperation behind the Claw's attempt to capture Frey. The plateau ended in a stark cliff on one side, and on the other was a jagged bit of rock, big enough to be called a mountain for our purposes, but it was solid rock and not the sort of thing that a body could simply walk over or through. Some planets feature mountains that are pleasant things to traverse, carved with twisting paths and resplendent with beauty and beasts, but the mountains of Parnassos are more like the claws of some great and unforgiving animal, hungry for blood. Without a word, Phasma urged her people forward, motioning for them to be quiet and quick. When they stood on the edge of the plateau, behind the crowd of Claw folk so mesmerized that they hadn't even noticed the interlopers, Phasma and her people finally saw the miracle occurring. Five figures were being pulled up onto the plateau from the land below. Edging around the utterly riveted group, the Skyr folk were fascinated to see that on the other side of Baldur's Plateau lay not the heaving waters of the dark, churning ocean, but land. And not land made of rock, or not only of rock. It was sand. Sand, as far as the eye could see, curving up in wavy dunes, the field of gray broken only by tumbled black rocks. Using her quadnox, Phasma followed the footprints and drag marks back to where a metal machine waited, half submerged in the sand and beside a huge, crumpled piece of fabric. It was the part of the ship that had popped off and gently floated down. The Skyr had never seen so much fabric in one piece in all their lives, and it was clear why several Claw members were down there, busily cutting the long lines that held the fabric to the machine so that they might claim it for their own. The downed ship was nowhere in sight, but far, far away, across the sands and yet more rocks. Phasma tracked the thin line of white smoke that feathered up into the sky, marking the path to true riches. A cheer went up as the first strange figure was dragged to standing on top of the plateau, his arm clutched in Baldur's bandaged foot. It was a man, and for Parnassos he wore very little, just finely woven clothes of a smooth, uniform black, and tall, shiny boots speckled with sand. He was the oldest person the Skyr folk had ever seen, with pale white skin and red hair going gray at the edges. Although his limbs were slender enough, his belly was big, and he had dark circles under his eyes.
He smiled blandly at the whoops and whistles of the claw folk, but was clearly not celebrating personally. Balder pushed him gently aside and reached for the next figure, a warrior wearing white armor streaked with gray sand over a thin suit of black. A gasp went over the claw folk, and the Skyre folk, too. Such armor would have given anyone on Parnassus a huge advantage over the elements.